It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gaffin. Billions of dollars are invested in scientific research, whether it's public tax dollars or businesses hoping for a payoff from a research investment. Much of that money also goes to major universities. But how do economics influence science? We're going to find out from Paula Stefan, professor of economics at Georgia State University, who visited recently at Washington and Jefferson College. Paula Stefan, welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be on your show.
Paula, please give us a sense of how do economics and science intertwine? How do they intersect?
Well, economics is really about incentives and cost. And incentives and costs play a very large role in science, and that's what I've spoken about here on my visit to Washington and Jefferson. I can give you some examples. Would you like some examples?
Please do.
So, for example, if you look at where scientists submit articles for publication, it turns out that a number of countries offer cash incentives for publishing in top journals. And we find a huge uptick in submissions from the countries that have started doing that, for example, from China and Korea. So that's just one example of how incentives play a role. Another example of how incentives play a role in science is if you look at what happened on university campuses. The National Institutes of Health budget doubled in the late 90s. And many universities assumed that this doubling would just keep on and on and on. And so they went on a building binge, and almost every medical school in the U.S. put up lots of new research space. And that was certainly incentive-driven. They thought they could attract top researchers to those facilities, and it would make them more likely to bring in more and more NIH money. And, of course, it turned out that the budget really slowed down. I mean, NIH always said it wouldn't continue doubling, and a lot of universities were left with some excess capacity and a lot of debt. So that's another example of how incentives affect the practice of science.
And don't decisions have to be made what scientific investigations we do fund, whether it's NIH doing it, and which we don't fund?
Absolutely. And one of the topics I've spoken about on my visit here is how it would appear that not just in the United States, but also in Europe, that we're becoming increasingly risk-averse about which projects we choose to fund.
So they're more cautious or what? And does that add to the cautious nature of the researchers themselves?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's real feedback. If you think NIH or NSF or in Europe the European Research Council are not going to fund really risky things, then you don't propose really risky research. And that seems to have a feedback mechanism in it. I mean, I think there are lots of drivers. It's just not the funding organizations that encourage this trend. It's also the extreme pressure on researchers at universities to bring in grant money. And you know, at a number of universities, researchers are on soft money positions. And so Stephen Quake, a biophysicist at Stanford, says it's funding or famine for these people. And if you can only, if that's going to pay your salary and you think that the reviewers might possibly be risk averse, it's not in your interest to propose risky research.
Does the research always have to have a bottom line payoff?
Definitely not. And in the past, I mean, one of the big arguments why the federal government or state government should support research is that we needed to support research that we weren't sure what the payoff was going to be, because a lot of times the payoffs are unknown and they're so far down the road. I mean, we all have GPS because of the atomic clock, and the atomic clock was conceived of in the 19th century. And Lord Kelvin had no idea that it was going to give us GPS, right? So, I mean, that kind of research can have a huge effect in our lives. But I will say that there's increasing pressure, I think, to be able to show what kind of payoff it may have. And there's a big concern that in the private sector that short-termism in terms of research has really increased dramatically. And there's lots of evidence in that in pharmaceuticals, for example, that we keep seeing copycat drugs being patented, and the kind of investments companies are making in terms of drugs to treat cancer. They're putting their money into drugs that extend life for 2 to 3 months rather than to drugs that extend life for much longer. And that's because of the economic incentives, I think.
Are you concerned that that pressure that you mentioned can taint the research itself?
Well, I'm not sure whether it taints it, but I think it directs it or redirects it into things that don't have as big a likelihood as shifting the knowledge frontier. And what really creates long-term benefits are things that make a fundamental shift in the knowledge frontier.
The knowledge frontier. So I was going to ask you, is research for research's sake, is that gone?
Well, I think that's very interesting. That's the kind of research for research's sake is, I think we'd say, research that you don't know what the outcome's going to be. Some people who study risk call that that's going to have ambiguous findings. You can't predict. You think you'll find something, but you don't know what it is. I think it's harder and harder to convince funding organizations to fund that. And at university campuses, there's a growing amount of resources that are coming from private donors. And private donors typically give money because they want a solution to a specific problem.
I have to ask you, what's coming next? What other connections might we be surprised by?
Well, right now, I'm just really, really interested in studying risk-taking in science and different approaches we can take to try to increase risk-taking.
Do we just sort of have to bet on the ingenuity, the creativity, the drive of our researchers to give them a chance to take risks, and somewhere down the line, it'll be beneficial?
One of the things that I think can really encourage this is that institutions, universities, and colleges have some special pool of funds where they can very easily give a researcher $100,000, $200,000 to work on an idea so that they can develop it kind of as a proof of concept and go forward for funding. I think that's really where there's a need. And if I were a development officer at a major university, that would be what I would be out raising money for.
Paula Stefan is a professor of economics at Georgia State University. She spoke recently at Washington and Jefferson College, and she's the author of How Economics Shapes Science. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. The 57th Carnegie International opens Saturday after 3 years of planning. One of the first things visitors will see inside the Carnegie Museum of Art will be sculptures by Thaddeus Moseley, who at age 92 is still working. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll visits the iconic local artist.
It starts with a 75-pound chunk of walnut.
You just start going down the line, follow that line, because I know I'm going to remove that.
Thad Moseley is in his basement studio in an industrial park on the north side. Moseley is compact and barrel-chested, and he exudes a calm cheerfulness. Wearing safety glasses and work gloves, he leans over the wood, sculpting with a mallet in one hand and a metal gouge in the other.
So you can see there's very little mystery to this. But it is some labor.
About the mystery, Moseley is being modest. He's shown his work around the country and has been one of Pittsburgh's most admired artists for decades. He's known for large-scale works up to 13 feet tall, their shapes alternately assertive and sensually rounded. Each sculpture has multiple segments that can weigh hundreds of pounds each, but are carefully balanced and cantilevered and can seem to float in space.
Sometimes some of his work looks as if it's going to fall, or it's teetering on the edge, the verge of falling, but yet it is deeply rooted and weighted, and it's not going to.
Kalolo Luckett, a local writer and curator, has known Moseley since the 90s. She sees his sculptures as a form of storytelling.
So I do think that tension creates its own complex, beautiful storytelling through the shaping of material through wood that Thad is so brilliantly a master at.
Moseley was born in Newcastle, Pennsylvania in 1926. He served in the military in World War II, studied journalism at the University of Pittsburgh, and reported on sports for the Pittsburgh Courier newspaper. He later began a long career at the U.S. Postal Service. He started sculpting in the 1950s, first by hand-carving 2x4s to copy decorative sculptures he'd seen on coffee tables at the old Kaufman's department store downtown. Eventually, he moved into more abstract forms.
My main idea is, of course, the idea of weight and space. And that idea is that the sculpture should look like it's levitating, it should look like there's movement.
Many contemporary sculptors assemble their works from man-made materials, consumer products, junkyard finds, or even 3D printed forms. But Moseley works by hand, mostly with hardwoods like cherry and walnut, sourced from a lumber mill near Uniontown. His influences include African tribal art and the Romanian sculptor Constantine Brancusi. Admirers call his work singular. One of them is Sandra Grimes, the curator who included 3 Moseley sculptures in a recent group show by African-American artists at Featherstone Center for the Arts in Massachusetts.
And you could put his work with a group of other people who are sculptors who work in wood, and you would know instantly which were his as opposed to the others.
In Moseley's work, you can see where he shaped the wood with his hand tools and even imagine the force he so carefully applied. The marks are like thumbprints, but they also serve an aesthetic purpose.
The chisel marks mean a lot of different things. So they're for contrast, then you'll see where some also different sizes of gouge marks, different rhythms. And so your eye should hopefully direct your eye to the spots that I would like to concentrate on.
The Carnegie International is a huge show, taking over the museum with work by dozens of artists from around the world. Moseley has 20 sculptures in the show, 13 indoors and 7 outdoors in the museum's sculpture garden, separated by a 2-story plate glass wall. Moseley had his first exhibit at the Carnegie 50 years ago, in 1968, but at 92, he still sculpts 7 days a week and shows little sign of slowing down.
The more you work at it, the better you're going to get.
I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
If you missed our interview with Carnegie International curator Ingrid Schaffner on yesterday's Confluence, you can find it at WESA.FM or wherever you get your favorite podcast. You're listening to The Confluence.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced the nominees for their induction class of 2019 on Tuesday morning, and the list is certainly impressive. Though it features 6 artists nominated for the first time, others have been down this road before. Will Kraftwerk finally get the recognition they deserve? Will LL Cool J knock the competition out in his 5th nomination? A likely safer bet would be Stevie Nicks, who has the potential to make history this year. If chosen, she'll be the first woman to be inducted as a solo artist and as a member of a band. You can cast your vote at rockhall.com or by complaining on Facebook like most people. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In a bit of an unusual move in 2009, Ann Metzger and Ron Bailey were appointed as co-directors of the Carnegie Science Center, and now both will retire by the end of the year. We're going to talk about the accomplishments over the past decade and what could be next for the Science Center. And Ron, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you very much.
Great to be here.
Science Center opened October of 91. Ron, I'm going to start with you. You've been there since even before the official Science Center in various educational capacities. And Ann, you joined the center in 2006 as Director of Marketing and Community Research. How did your experiences, your skill sets mesh to be successful co-directors? Ron, I'll start with you.
Well, my background at the Science Center, I started in 1983, 1 year after they had changed their name. For people that have been in Pittsburgh for a long time, they'll remember it was the Buell Planetarium,
right,
an Institute of Popular Science. And in 1982, the board decided that they wanted to create a science center, basically broaden the the programming that the planetarium did from just astronomy-based programming to all sciences. And so they changed the name to Buell Science Center and began to do programming and develop exhibits. And that's what brought me on board a year later, as they were broadening into, at that time, was computers and technology, and wanting to do programming and exhibits around that.
All right, so Ron and his programming and this new commitment, this broadening of it, and you and your marketing skills, so how did those two come together to make that success, as I alluded to?
Well, let me tell you how I came to Carnegie Science Center, because I spent most of my career in marketing and communications at UPMC. Mm-hmm. And UPMC was a funder of Carnegie Science Center, actually had their name on the first SportsWorks exhibit that opened in 2001. And it was through that process that I first met Ron. I was still at UPMC, and he was at the Science Center. When I later left UPMC, I still had this love for the Science Center. I kind of fell in love with it back there before 2006. And so when I joined as the director of marketing, we began to work together as colleagues on the senior leadership team.
Okay, so now as the senior leaders, as co-directors, did it take a while to sort of build up a trust because you're coming at it from, in a sense, different backgrounds, different approaches?
Well, we had worked together as peers.
Right.
So I was largely on the education side and was on the marketing side. So we sat at the same senior leadership table for a number of years before we started to work together as co-directors. I think we knew that we were very complementary in our skill sets and what we brought to the planning and the leadership. And it actually didn't take very long. We were going to give it a try, and we were going to see how it worked. And a lot of people were telling us, you know, this never works. You know, that co-director thing will never work. We heard that. But it never really became a challenge for us. It actually became very smooth very quickly. We began, the prior director said, what you're going to want to do is draw a line and say, Ann will do these things, Ron, you'll do these things. And we learned in about the first 2 weeks that that doesn't really fly. We both needed to have our hands in just about everything. And that's the way we have approached it over these 10 years.
All right. And do you concur? Are you going to disagree with your partner here?
I absolutely concur. And what we realized early on, as Ron said, within the first 2 weeks, I was thinking it took about a week and a half. But we knew that we had to communicate fully. There was no such thing as playing games and holding things back. We knew that we needed to let each other know all of our communications that occurred. And we also knew that we needed to present a unified front to the rest of the staff. We didn't want staff to feel that they could ask one a question and get a yes and the other a question and get a no. We decided that we would stick together on all of those decisions.
Okay. So what's the joint retirement planned as well? And if so, was it because you had some major projects that had, you know, come to fruition, whether it was, you know, a very successful capital campaign or the completion of the PPG Science Pavilion?
It was planned. We had this conversation. Really, it started a couple of years ago when we saw the project on the horizon, and we said, you know, let's think about what our benchmarks will be for when we exit the organization. And we knew that there were things we needed to accomplish. We needed to raise all the funds to build our new expansion. We needed to open that expansion and run it for a few months and get things up and running and also begin to nurture the next generation of leadership at the Science Center before we'd be ready to depart. But we're approximately the same age, and so we would be ready to retire at about the same time. And we just picked the date early on but didn't tell anybody.
Well, so whether it was during your leadership or while you were in the first few years as a director of marketing and Ron, your three decades of experience, I want to know, did the mission, the goal of the Science Center change? Did it broaden?
You know what? It's really interesting because when Buell Planetarium opened in 1939, they were the fifth planetarium in the United States.
Yeah.
And the others were all named planetarium, is the Adler Planetarium, the Hayden Planetarium. The team that formed the planetarium in Pittsburgh made the name Buell Planetarium, but they added an Institute of Popular Science. They always had this vision of wanting to be a place where current, relevant, popular science topics would be accessible to our visitors. So that goes all the way back. And so as they became a science center, it was really trying to live into that same vision to broaden science. And so it has broadened quite a lot over the years. One of the beautiful things about a science center is we don't really draw any lines about what we can and can't do related to science. We can talk about anything that's relevant and meaningful and is of interest to our visitor, and so we do.
If scientists drew lines, we'd be in a lot of trouble, I guess.
That's true. It's really true. And we've broadened our topics. When you talk about how we've evolved, I think with this new expansion, we've come to think of ourselves not just as a place for kids and families to come and have a wonderful visit, but also for people of all ages to learn about science. And then our extensive educational outreach reaches many, many people who don't actually visit the center.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that. So the mission, the goals, but the role within the community of the Science Center, always a fascinating cultural attraction to bring people in. But it's, and you alluded to, more and more about education and an educational partner.
Yes. Well, we see about 500,000 people on site at the Science Center each year. We are the number one visited museum in the Pittsburgh region. But we also see an additional almost 200,000 kids each year in educational outreach programs in schools throughout the entire region. We've gone across the country. But the main places we are Western Pennsylvania and down into West Virginia. So we take assembly programs, we have microscope workshops, we have classroom programs, all kinds of activities to interest kids and excite them about science.
About the excitement, the mystery of science. You're making science fun, Ron.
Absolutely. I mean, that has been the goal always. And, you know, as we work with young people especially, too often we find young people kind of turn off to science and math early on. In fact, research tells us around fourth grade. So we work with early learners. I mean, we have an early learner classroom for the Pittsburgh Public Schools on site at the Science Center. It's a great classroom. Imagine having the Science Center as your classroom every day. And that's what this class has. And that's because we want to continue to nurture that interest and the fun and the enjoyment of science and exploration and discovery and curiosity with this next generation that's coming up.
How do you view that evolution and the important growing role as an educator, as an education partner, if you will, and the need for that, but that the education just isn't just limited to the school building, that you can get the hands-on sort of enhancement of that education, whether it's at the Science Center or the Science Center coming to the schools?
Well, no kid was ever inspired by sitting in a classroom and taking a multiple choice test, were they? But we all know that we get excited about hands-on activities, about projects that we do. And so we take that kind of interest that kids have outside of school and we channel it into the skills that they're going to need in the 21st century workforce. And a lot of the discussions we've had over the last number of years with members of our board and other members of the corporate community are their extreme need for a STEM-educated workforce. And so we're trying to create that next-generation workforce.
And we think that one of the best ways we can inspire young people is to help them meet and interact with real professionals who are in the field now. So we try in every way we can to get kids talking to civil engineers and meteorologists and chemists and talk about what they do, the cool problems they're working on, why they are excited to get up and do the job they do every day. We think that's a way that we really inspire kids when you talk to somebody who's doing it every day and can tell them. We can tell them all the time that you ought to consider these kinds of careers. When you talk to somebody who's in that career, why they do it, what they were doing when they were 12 or 14, and how they got interested in it, that's really important, and we think that goes a long way to help inspire.
You offer all these programs, all these opportunities inside the building, inside the Science Center, and on the road at the schools. But do you sense that the fascination with science is still strong, is stronger? Do you have to sort of do more to spark that fascination?
I think that that kids are born as natural scientists. And what we have to do, well, our job is to help them explore and nurture that natural curiosity that every kid has. If you look at a toddler, you can see them exploring the world around them. Let's just keep that going. Let's not tamper that out of them in grade school.
I definitely think that it's actually increasing. I think as more and more children are in classrooms and schools where They approach math and science in exciting and engaging ways. I think we're able to maintain that interest longer. And in many ways, to address what Ann was saying, we just need to sort of get out of the way and let kids who are natural, have a natural curiosity, continue to develop that.
All right. I got to ask you. Do you ever eavesdrop on kids when they come to the Science Center and hearing the maybe the oohs and ahs and just sort of, you know, being reinforced, your enthusiasm being reinforced by their experience at the Science Center, their experience of learning about science in that fun way? So all do you eavesdrop, Anne?
All the time. Those are the best times because, you know, we run the Science Center and it's a job like any other job, and there are some days that are tougher than others. On those days, what we love to do is just get out of the office, walk up on the floor, and we see discovery and excitement, and we remember why we do what we do every day.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you a little story. We opened this past year a new early learner space on our fourth floor. And as part of that, we have a button wall, and it's for it's like 3, 4, 5, and 6-year-olds. And it's more than 100 buttons, and every button you press will do something else. It might make a sound. It may cause something to happen. Well, one of the buttons causes bubbles to come out and just flow down over the kids. Well, we watched the very first day a bunch of 3- and 4-year-olds playing with the buttons. And it took them probably 10 minutes before somebody realized there's a bubble button. And they quickly organized themselves so that one person stood there and just kept hitting the bubble button. And so the bubbles just kept coming. And the part that we never planned is that as those bubbles came, and there were so many, it landed on this tile floor, and it became extremely slippery. And so now kids were standing at the other end and running and sliding across the floor through all this bubble soap on the floor. No one planned that. And that happened within about 30 minutes. A group of 3- and 4-year-olds figured this whole thing out. And that's the kind of natural curiosity we want to continue to build. That's just shows that even at that age, if they're motivated, what they can accomplish if they want to do it.
Well, and communication and collaboration, right?
Absolutely.
They just work together
skills,
to make it happen,
right? Yeah.
So we have just a couple of minutes left. So a giant cinema. And I'm going to leave out plenty because there's too much to talk about. A giant cinema, various interactive exhibits, education programs galore, STEM Center to inspire teachers, maybe even future scientists, a World War II era submarine, the science of sports. What else can the center do? Or is it like science, always something else to explore and to learn?
There is always something else to explore and to learn. And we have these discussions on an ongoing basis. What is our next big thing? What is our next big exhibit? You forgot the robots, by the way.
I forgot robots. How can you forget robots in this town?
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly. So we're thinking about what that next big experience will be. Ron and I will be gone by the time that's unveiled, but our team is really on it and thinking about it all the time.
That's how you end up 35 years in this job. For me, people say, how could you stay 35 years? Because it's always a new project. There's always a new opportunity around every corner, and you can't walk away from it. Then you look back one day and, wow, 35 years later.
Very briefly, I asked you before about, do you eavesdrop on the kids? What about the parents who maybe experienced something at the Buell originally and said, oh my goodness, look at all that's expanded and look at all these great opportunities? Or maybe it's even the grandparents taking their kids as well. Are they just amazed as well?
I think so. Absolutely. We hear stories all the time from the Buell. People will say, I remember, we still have that Zeiss projector that everybody remembers from the old
planetarium. I remember Transpara.
Right, and Transpara, yes, the talking transparent woman, and those programs that we did with those pieces. People remember that. And, of course, I think, of all those things, the railroad, the miniature railroad and village is certainly primary. Grandparents now and their kids and their grandkids all remember it and come every year to see it.
Well, we congratulate you on your great work, and we wish you the best in each of your retirements, and thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Ann Metzger and Ron Bailey are co-directors of the Carnegie Science Center since 2009. They'll both retire by the end of the year. And by the way, the Science Center has named Jason Brown as interim director following their retirements. He's currently the Science Center's senior director of science and education. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, Getting Around the City, how to meet the needs of pedestrians, motorists, mass transit riders, bike riders. Not easy. We'll visit with the Director of Infrastructure and Mobility. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.